This is The Takeaway for September the 19th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us today.
Mr. Secretary General, Mr. President, world leaders, and distinguished delegates, welcome to New York. It is a profound honor to stand here in my home city as a representative of the American people to address the people of the world.
That was President Donald Trump speaking at the United Nations General Assembly today, his first time as president. And the America First agenda that the president promised was delivered on Tuesday. The president emphasized sovereignty as a key to world order, stressing that nations should prioritize their own interests, even while criticizing governments like Venezuela and Cuba for how they handle their own affairs.
As president of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first.
North Korea and Iran were singled out with harsh rhetoric. The president praised sanctions against North Korea, but then he issued a threat from one of the loudest microphones in world diplomacy.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
President Trump went on to refer to Iran as a murderous regime and an economically depleted rogue state. And he also kept speculation going on whether the United States would stick with the UN-backed Iran nuclear deal.
Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it. Believe me.
Let's get some analysis on the speech now and on the evolving U.S. role in the United Nations. Uri Friedman is staff writer at The Atlantic. He covers global and U.S. foreign policy. Uri, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Todd.
It's great to have you, too. I heard a lot of talk from the president, the word sovereignty, I don't know how many times in that speech, but really pushing the idea of the independent sovereignty of nations over and over. I did not hear in that speech the traditional defense of American democratic ideals and America as the light of democracy around the world. I didn't hear that.
No, that was remarkably absent relative to the addresses of past presidents. He did invoke democracy in certain respects. So he criticized the government of Venezuela for being an authoritarian government. He said the Iranian government oppresses its people. But there was really an absence of that relative to, if you compare it to, for example, a Barack Obama speech or even a John F. Kennedy speech. I think what Trump was trying to do here is he's an America First president, and he's a continued member of an organization that puts the world first. So how do you reconcile that? And I think his solution in this speech was a concept of sovereignty. The argument was basically countries are independent, they act in their own self-interest, and that is the way that the United Nations was founded. But sometimes those self-interests overlap, and when there are common interests, that is when the United Nations is strongest. So it's almost like a bottom-up vision of the United Nations as opposed to a top-down one. That's very different. For example, John F. Kennedy in 1963 said absolute sovereignty is impossible because it doesn't guarantee absolute security. In an age when we have nuclear weapons and other collective international challenges, we have to have some top-down governance like the United Nations. So this was a departure.
Principled realism is a doctrine that the president talked about here, which is of a piece of what you're talking about, Uri Friedman, but principled realism also excludes the term idealism, which is a theme that many U.S. presidents in fora like this have used before.
Yeah, I think what he was trying to argue there is that the United States has certain principles, like, for example, sovereignty, like, for example, countries being able to determine their own destinies. But when I think Donald Trump talks about realism, what he's saying is he doesn't want to dictate to other countries the way they should live, the systems of governments they should have. He doesn't want to remake other countries in America's image, which is a reference to kind of George W. Bush's mission in Iraq, and that he really just thinks, countries are essentially transactional. They want what is good for their country. And we have to recognize that and craft foreign policy, you know, in light of that. Now, in some people might say that is a very different vision than the United States has had in the past, or at least articulated in the past. Other people are saying, well, you know, the United States has often invoked these lofty ideals but not practiced what it preached and actually engaged in a lot of transactional behavior. So some people would say Donald Trump is just articulating what the U.S. leaders have actually done in practice rather than what they've said in their rhetoric.
So there may be an interpretation here, as you're saying, that Trump is just being a lot more honest about American actions and intentions around the world. Uri Friedman, try to bring us inside the minds of some of the delegates and the world leaders around that room there. And I realize that there are 192 nations, if that's the right number. Every country has different priorities. But Ambassador Nick Burns was on this show just a day or two ago, describing, especially in Europe and in a lot of countries around the world, there's a perception that Donald Trump has abdicated leadership of the West, of the Democratic West. Doesn't necessarily mean the United States has, because he won't be president forever, but that there's lost time here. Do you agree with that assessment? Do other countries around the Great Hall there at the UN think that?
I think some countries do. I think a lot of, for example, if you look at a lot of European countries, Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, is in attendance. I think they would argue that they see that abdication of responsibility in regard to, for example, climate change. Climate change is an international problem. It affects all countries. And you need a country or a group of countries to lead that kind of effort. That is not something that any one country can do alone. And I think a lot of European leaders feel that the U.S. has abdicated responsibility in regard to leading on climate change. Now, others are picking up the ball, right? So Germany is, France is, China to a certain extent is, but they would say the United States is not doing that. I think another place where that would be the case is on free trade. You know, Donald Trump withdrew from the TPP, an Asia-Pacific trade deal, and I think there is thought that other countries need to kind of pick up the slack there. I don't think that you can just say in a sweeping statement that the United States has totally abdicated its international responsibility. I think on the concept of terrorism, for example, the United States is doing what it did under Obama and what it did under George W. Bush. It's really leading that effort. It's trying to get Middle Eastern countries like Saudi Arabia to do more to root out the ideology. It's done a lot of progress in actually reducing the territory that ISIS controls in Syria and Iraq. So I think it really depends. It's kind of issue by issue. I think where you're seeing it biggest is climate change, free trade, and really the promotion of democracy and human rights. That's where I feel like there is a void, and other countries are nervous that if the United States doesn't fill it, are other countries up to the challenge, and can they do it collectively because they don't have the power that the United States has?
Mm. Well, let's talk about some of the specific cases in some of the specific countries that the president mentioned in his speech and went after some of America's rivals with some pretty stark rhetoric. I will say, just to start, only veiled references to Russia or China in that speech. The president at one point said that America would stand against violations of sovereignty in Ukraine, which seems like a veiled, certainly is a veiled swipe at Russia, and in the South China Sea, a veiled swipe at China. But in the case of North Korea, where the confrontation is growing increasingly hot, Uri Friedman, the president called the government of North Korea a band of criminals, talked about their nuclear testing, talked about their testing of missiles, called Kim Jong-un his famous Twitter insult now Rocket Man, which was an interesting choice for the diplomatic sort of culture of the UN. But then I'll also repeat this line, which was fairly stark, warning that if North Korea lashes out in any way, and I'm quoting here, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. That had to take delegates aback in the hall.
That was by far the most remarkable passage of the speech. I'd recommend listeners read and reread that portion of the transcript of the speech, because that was, I mean, extremely belligerent, bellicose language. Yeah. You know, he was vague. It's worth pointing out. He was vague on what would cause the United States to totally destroy North Korea, right? He said, you know, if they don't stop their destructive behavior. But this gets at the vague things that the president and his advisors have said in the past about, you know, so what are we talking about here? Is it North Korean threats? Is it firing missiles toward Guam? Is it actually demonstrating the capability to hit the United States with a nuclear weapon? Is it the sign of an imminent nuclear attack? So we really don't know what would trigger that kind of overwhelming response. And potentially that's deliberate. They want to be vague so that North Korea says, oh, we don't want to do anything provocative. But there was no, I would say there was no articulation of new policy here. We didn't say, you know, some kind of red line drawn on what specific behavior North Korea can't take. But what we did see is almost Trump being Trump here, calling him Rocket Man, using the most threatening language possible, which he is an advocate of, because he says that, you know, North Korea only understands one thing, which is threats and the potential use of force. And what we also saw is a kind of laying of the groundwork for if the United States does decide in the unlikely possibility to take military action against North Korea, this is kind of a basis for that. We saw this a little bit in 2002 before the Iraq War. George W. Bush came out in front of the same UN General Assembly and gave a long, long litany of reasons why there might have to be action with or without the United Nations against Iraq. So we saw something similar in a little bit of a more limited form, a less specific form, here with North Korea, him laying out the reasons why it is a threat, as he put it, to the entire world.
Well, Uri Friedman, we have just about 2 minutes left with you, and I want to make sure we talk about the case of Iran as well. The president criticized the Maduro regime in Venezuela, criticized the government in Cuba, which is pretty standard American Republican fare. On Iran, it was remarkable as well. The president called Iran a murderous regime and criticized the Iran nuclear deal, called it an embarrassment to the United States. He hasn't pulled out of that deal yet, but he also said, I don't think you've heard the last of it. The president is fond of these kinds of sort of warnings about policy. But if you watch the cutaway shot, Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, nods as the president starkly criticizes Iran.
Yeah, Todd, I got to say, I'm going to keep looking at that line. I don't think you've heard the last of it again and again, puzzling over what that means, because that is a very vague line that could mean a lot of different things. So what is happening is October 15th, Trump faces a deadline about whether he wants to recertify this Iran deal. And he did not give a very specific indication here of whether he's going to recertify or not. But what he did say is that Iran is engaging in all types of provocative behavior. Netanyahu agrees with that and wants stricter rules around this agreement. The biggest concern for them is that this agreement ends. It has a deadline in 10 and 15 years. And so what I could see happening is either a decertification of the deal on October 15th or the Trump administration continuing with the deal but trying to mobilize support internationally for ways to mitigate against the fact that this ends in 10 or 15 years and trying to extend these deadlines. So that was kind of the suggestion he had, but he did not make that specific. We did not get any new clarity about whether he will certify the deal or not certify it in mid-October.
So just before we let you go in the last couple of seconds, Uri Friedman, we saw a lot of strong rhetoric. You saw Trump being Trump and not a lot of, if I'll call it, new diplomatic real news here. The United States taking a new direction that we didn't already have an idea about.
No, I don't think that. I mean, he was using a teleprompter. He didn't really go off script a lot. So it was him being using a lot of his rhetoric, but it wasn't new policy. The biggest thing, I think, is this is what you saw. This was the fullest articulation we've seen so far of how Trump squares America first, his nationalist agenda, with the fact that America is a global leader in the world and one of the most powerful countries in the world. If you want to look at an articulation of that, it's here.
Uri Friedman is staff writer at The Atlantic. He covers global affairs and U.S. foreign policy. And now a look at President Trump's right-hand woman at the United Nations, Ambassador Nikki Haley. President Trump, like a lot of Republicans before him, has criticized the United Nations and called for reform. He did it again today. And Nikki Haley has said that the changes at the UN the president demanded on the campaign trail have already come into effect.
It is a new day at the UN. What you are now seeing is The Israel bashing has become more balanced. You've got a United Nations that's action-oriented. We've passed two resolutions on North Korea just in the last month. And you also have a United Nations that is totally moving towards reform. We said that we needed to get value for our dollar, and what we're finding is the international community is right there with us in support of reform. So it is a new day at the UN.
So we wanted to find out how Ambassador Nikki Haley is doing in her role, and is she promoting the president's America First agenda at the UN? To help break down what has changed at the United Nations with Nikki Haley as ambassador and what she hopes to accomplish on behalf of her boss, Donald Trump, I spoke earlier with Richard Gowan. He's a fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and he also teaches at Columbia University.
I think Nikki Haley's doctrine has been to try to balance the Trump administration's America First rhetoric with more practical diplomacy, especially over North Korea. Power was and is a great expert on the United Nations, and she really cared about the nitty-gritty of peacekeeping operations and humanitarian aid. Haley is, by her own admission, not a UN expert, and she is sitting in New York really trying to navigate the storms of the Trump administration while keeping foreign diplomats on side.
So how does she do that in the real world at the UN? Let's take an example. A North Korean missile launch, the president tweets that the response from the United States will be fire and fury. That's not diplomatic speak and probably doesn't do well in a forum like the UN. How does she handle it?
Haley has developed pretty collegial relations with the representatives of other major countries, especially the other permanent members of the Security Council. And she works in a good, solid diplomatic way, and she has been able to negotiate two pretty tough resolutions on North Korea. Now, she makes compromises. She has demanded some measures against North Korea, such as a total cutoff of energy, that China in particular simply won't accept. And when necessary, Haley backs down. This is good diplomacy. As well as being a good diplomat, though, she's a good politician. So she's quite skilled at wheeling, dealing, compromising in New York, and then going out to the media, going back to Republicans in Washington, and selling whatever she's achieved as a big, big win for the US. In the second quarter of this year, she said that she wanted to cut $1 billion from the UN peacekeeping budget, which overall adds up to about $8 billion. Other countries wouldn't accept that because they thought the cuts were too savage. They would undermine Blue Helmet operations in places like South Sudan. So behind closed doors, Haley and her team compromised on a cut of $500 million, half of what she wanted. Now, that was fine with everyone. It was possible to find savings that didn't do any great damage to any UN mission. Diplomats were happy. The countries that contribute troops to UN missions were happy. But then Haley was able to go back to Washington and make some very strong statements about how she had saved money for the US taxpayer. Again, classic diplomacy. You give just enough to keep your foreign counterparts on board, and then you take your partial success home and boast about it all over Twitter and all over the media.
And what about with your boss, who loves to make incendiary statements not only about the United Nations, but about world affairs? It's one thing for Nikki Haley to make these deals at the UN, but then you say she effectively can turn around and keep the White House happy and ostensibly keep the president happy too.
I think Haley does sometimes struggle to keep the president happy, but ironically, that's because she's good at her job. And there have been a couple of occasions this year where there have been stories in the media about how Haley seems to be the most effective member of the cabinet and perhaps even presidential material in her own right. And sitting here in New York, we've noticed that whenever that happens, Trump and his team go out of their way to take her down a notch or two. You suddenly get a little tide of briefing coming from Washington about how Trump will rein Haley in. Even after the last Security Council negotiations on North Korea, which resulted in a pretty good sanctions resolution, Trump went out of his way to say that he didn't think the resolution would work. And our assumption is that is because the president is nervous that Haley is outshining him.
Lots of people have natural political skills, and I hear you saying that Nikki Haley has significant natural political skills, but no experience in diplomacy. So where did she learn this?
I think that we sometimes overestimate how difficult diplomacy is. Haley had a really testing training in South Carolina as governor. I think the politics of being governor of a major state actually does prepare you quite well for the wheeling and dealing that is necessary in New York. There were a lot of people who were quite patronizing towards her when she was offered the post of U.S. ambassador to the U.N. last year. They thought that someone who hadn't been out in the field, who didn't have the U.N. expertise of someone like Samantha Power, would crash and burn in the Security Council. But Haley has a knack for diplomatic negotiation, and she's also supported by a really professional team of diplomats at the U.S. mission to the U.N., and she's making it work.
And finally, her potential presidential future that you and everyone else talks about and apparently the White House is not fond of talking about, is ambassador to the United Nations a potential way to get there?
There is at least one previous ambassador to the United Nations who became president. That was George Bush Sr. Look, Haley's doing very well, but I think we all know that there have been many, many US politicians who've been called presidential hopefuls and then never quite make it to the finish line. I think Chris Christie, if he ever listens to The Takeaway, would recognize that. I think Haley has what it takes to go beyond the UN. I doubt she's going to be at the UN more than a year or two. Is she going to get to the White House? I think that is in the lap of the gods.
Richard Gowan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Richard Gowan is with the European Council on Foreign Relations and teaches at Columbia University. Coming up later this hour, David Litt wrote speeches and jokes for President Obama.
People always used to ask me, do you write jokes to try to advance the president's agenda? And I would always say no, by which I always meant yes. And the reason for that was just I felt it ought to be worth the president's time to go tell a bunch of jokes.
David Litt's new book is called Thanks Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. And we asked you, is it important that politicians have a sense of humor? Tell us your favorite joke from political history.
Hi, I'm Dave. I'm calling from Newark, New Jersey. And I think the best witticism about Washington, D.C. and politics was from none other than Harry Truman, who said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. I think that's the most appropriate thing ever said about Washington.
My name is Patty Halajan, and I live in Kildare, Illinois. What's my favorite joke from political history? Well, just about anything that Al Franken says. I love that man. I'm reading his book. It's a great book. And anything he's got to say, I love.
I was sitting on the dais, and a Secret Serviceman walked up with this note from the Hay Adams. It says, Al, don't be nervous. There's nobody important here. Dick Cavett. So... Dick Cavett's here, so someone... Let me get this thing out of here. Anyway, it's a tremendous honor to be short.
Hi, this is Maggie from Miami. I think they should have enough sense of humor to identify a joke. To be comical in the workplace, I don't think is necessary outside of their personal preference. Is it important for comedians to be more political?
This is Marilyn from East Hampton, Massachusetts. I recall reading a comment about listening to Adlai Stevenson give a campaign speech in the, I think it was the 56th election. And after the speech, someone came up to him, shook his hand and said, you'll have every thinking man's vote. And Adlai Stevenson replied, I'll need to do better than that. I have to have a majority.
And we got this from East Boston, Massachusetts. How about Tip O'Neill, former Speaker of the House, when he said, don't write it if you can talk, don't talk if you can wink, and don't wink if you can nod. And also, East Boston loves this moment, the 1984 campaign, President Ronald Reagan, when his political opponents suggested Reagan was too old to continue as president.
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
And Charlotte, North Carolina goes back to 1988 for this Lloyd Benson diss of Dan Quayle.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
More political jokes and joke writing for the president later this hour. That's on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Roadside Attractions, presenting Stronger, starring Jake Gyllenhaal as Jeff Bowman, whose strength became a symbol of hope after a national tragedy. In theaters September 22nd. By Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. Yet another devastating storm is pounding the Caribbean. It's the fourth major hurricane this season. Hurricane Maria started as a Category 1 storm, but intensified to Category 5 within a day. Maria tore through the islands of Dominica and Guadeloupe as a Category 4 storm last night, causing widespread damage. The Prime Minister of Dominica himself said on Facebook that he was rescued as winds ripped the roof off of his house. The storm re-intensified to a Category 5 storm and is on track to make landfall in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico dodged a direct hit from Irma just 2 weeks ago, you'll remember. Donica Cotto is reporter and editor for the Associated Press based in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Donica, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you back, Donica, but there is a feeling of grim repetition here. Yet another huge storm bearing down on Puerto Rico since we last talked to you. I know that hurricanes are a part of life there, but how are people coping now?
Well, I think most people are pretty apprehensive about this. The governor said this morning that it is the first time that a storm of this magnitude approaches Puerto Rico in a generation at least. And there's been about more than 10 years that Puerto Rico hasn't seen something of this size. So yesterday you had very long lines, people buying water, batteries, gasoline, hurricane shutters, and the government instituted or imposed rationing. So they said X amount of materials for families, you get X amount of water, X amount of batteries, baby formula, just to ensure that everybody has the supplies that they need. The governor did say he was worried that only about 200 people are in shelter so far and that he wants to see that number increase.
What have authorities in Guadalupe said about the damage there?
We're still trying to get a hold of officials this morning. They have said that many of the communities, especially in the southern portion of the island, will probably be underwater as a result of Maria and, you know, the other concern as well as in Dominica.
So, Donica Cotto, there was this stark warning that we saw from Puerto Rico's public safety commissioner to people who live in wooden or poorly protected houses. He said, you have to evacuate, otherwise you're going to die. Was this hyperbole to get people to pay attention, or are authorities in Puerto Rico really that worried?
It might be in part, but when Hurricane Irma passed near Puerto Rico, it only unleashed tropical storm force winds. And as a result of that, there were nearly 100 homes that were destroyed in an area called Loíza, which is on the northeast coast of Puerto Rico. And authorities truly believe that if people do not evacuate and if they remain in flimsy structures, that there will be deaths.
Meanwhile, recovery efforts from Irma are going on all over the island. Isn't that right? Even though the damage wasn't devastating, there still was plenty of damage. How is this storm affecting those efforts?
Well, that's a great question. There's still about nearly 70,000 people without power. So many are heading into the storm without having had power for 2 weeks. And the governor said it's unclear when power would be restored. There would be an island-wide power outage, and he's unable to say when the lights will come back on. In addition to that, there's still dozens of people in shelters as a result of Irma. So it's just an ongoing thing for many of these people who have not had power and have not been able to return to their homes yet.
Well, authorities and meteorologists are watching Hurricane Maria and its progress across the Caribbean. Donica Cotto, when exactly is it expected to hit Puerto Rico?
It's expected to hit on Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern, but authorities warn that the conditions will start to deteriorate and that by 8 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday night, there will be heavy wind and rain, and that the island will be hit with hurricane force winds for several hours and between 12 to 24 hours with tropical storm force winds.
Hurricane Maria is now a Category 5 storm as it heads yet again toward Puerto Rico, just in the recovery phase from Hurricane Irma just last week. Danica Cotto with the Associated Press in San Juan, thank you once again.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go to Capitol Hill now, where there's a last-ditch effort once again to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and it appears to be gaining momentum in the Senate. Now, you'll remember that back in July, the GOP's repeal efforts failed pretty dramatically when Mitch McConnell couldn't find 50 Republican votes for it. But in recent weeks, some Republicans have been working on another bill that could get 50 votes. But there's a catch here. Because of Senate rules, the bill would have to pass by September 30th to enjoy a 50-vote threshold. After that, you need 60 votes. And that's certain doom if you want to repeal Obamacare in the Senate. Lisa Mascaro is congressional correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Lisa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
So Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana have this new bill that I'm talking about. Refresh us as to what exactly this last-ditch repeal effort does.
Senator Bill Cassidy has sort of been working tirelessly. You know, he's a medical doctor, and this is an issue that is near and dear to him. He has been trying to build a plan that could gather support. Essentially, he's working off the past ideas that Republicans have put forward. You know, for Republicans, repealing and replacing Obamacare was always a great slogan, but was not a very well-defined actual policy. And so he is putting together a bill that would essentially take the tax revenue that is raised through the Affordable Care Act and distribute it more broadly to all states in the form of block grant monies that they could use to cover the patients in their states on Medicaid. It's seen by some as a more equitable way to cover more broadly folks in Medicaid. But, you know, these efforts in the past have shown us that there's just not enough money raised to cover as many people as the Affordable Care Act covers now. And so what you would be doing is taking funds away from the states that chose to expand their Medicaid coverage under Obamacare and passing it more narrowly through all 50 states. And that is certain to bring fewer Americans covered. As you remember, perhaps the original ideas that Republicans were coming up with were, you know, something like 20 million people would be losing their coverage under these efforts that Republicans are putting through. And this bill would likely have the same kinds of coverage gaps and leave more Americans uncovered.
So that's largely people on Medicaid, Lisa. What about people who get their insurance on the exchanges under the Affordable Care Act?
Right. Americans on the exchanges have been sort of living in a day-to-day situation because the Trump administration has wanted to cut back these subsidies, especially something called the cost-sharing reductions that are a second form of subsidy that really bring down the cost for the most low-income Americans that are having to buy insurance on their own. Every month, it's unclear whether the Trump administration is going to cut off these subsidies. It's creating a lot of havoc in the market. And under the Cassidy bill, these two would be reduced. And of course, the sort of main element of the Cassidy bill, as well as previous Republican efforts, would be to do away with the individual mandate, which is the requirement that all Americans carry insurance.
So Lisa, back in the Senate, though, we seem to be on some familiar ground here. Rand Paul of Kentucky is saying he's not voting for this, so we know that. But several other senators are leaning no, saying they're thinking about it. It's coming down to the wire. A lot of that feels pretty familiar to me. Where do things stand?
Now, you remember Republicans have a very slim margin in the Senate. And even with this special 50-vote rule that they're working at, they can only afford to lose three Republicans. You have the three who voted against it last time, Senator John McCain, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Senator Susan Collins of Maine. All three have different issues that they're working with. And this new bill may not bridge the gap for them. What's happening now is Lindsey Graham and Senator Bill Cassidy are really working with the state governors, trying to get the Republican governors in these states to show their support. You know, again, I will say, though, you know, John McCain is not one easily pressured, as we all know. We've seen him sort of act on his own. Senator Lisa Murkowski in Alaska faces very specific health issues to the state of Alaska, where costs are very high, much higher than in the rest of the country. It's going to be difficult to bring these senators on board for any plan and hold together this very narrow coalition.
One last chance for Senate Republicans to try to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Lisa Mascaro with the Los Angeles Times, thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot, Todd.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
There were numerous instances of property damage in a concentrated area, which included broken windows, flower pots smashed, trash cans overturned.
After the demonstrations, organizers announced that the daytime protest was over, but a group of agitators stayed behind, apparently intent on breaking windows and destroying property.
We're in control. This is our city, and we're going to protect it.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and you're hearing their sounds as demonstrators turned out for the fourth day in a row in St. Louis, Missouri, protesting against the acquittal of former police officer Jason Stockley on first-degree murder charges in the 2011 shooting death of a young black man named Anthony Smith. The voice you heard at the end of that sound was St. Louis Police Chief Larry O'Toole saying, "This is our city." The Associated Press and others reported that some police officers chanted, "Whose streets? Our streets," while arresting protesters, and police later tweeted out the names and addresses of people who they arrested. Amy Hunter is here with me now. She's a native of Missouri who is active in social justice issues and has participated in some of the demonstrations in Ferguson and more recently in St. Louis. She's manager of diversity and inclusion at St. Louis Children's Hospital and joined our program in the wake of Michael Brown's death in Ferguson and joins us now once again. Amy Hunter, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Describe some of the demonstrations. We heard some sound there at the top. Talk about this weekend and Monday night and how they turned violent with some property damage around St. Louis.
So I think a lot of people are talking about the property damage. I think what's key in having the conversation, as you could hear active chief of police, is that this is our city. And I think, you know, the people who are demonstrating feel like it's our city as well. And that the safety of our bodies is more important than the safety of a glass window or a trash can that is turned over, even a flower pot. And so just kind of keeping in touch with, you know, why people are demonstrating right now, I think is the key to how we figure out solutions for the problems around the justice system and how it is not working for everyone.
So what are people then saying about this decision, this acquittal of Officer Jason Stockley? Their reaction to this verdict, but also it has to be in context of protests around Ferguson a couple of years ago.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the majority of the people who are protesting or demonstrating are talking about what the whole system looks like. So not just the conduct of the officer, but the decision of the judge and his words and comments reflected as well, that the entire, you know, system of the justice system needs to be looked at and really, really critiqued on, is it fair and rational all the time for everyone? And so I think that's what people are asking for. I don't think people are asking for some kind of preferential treatment of the justice system. I think they're just asking for one that works for everyone justly. And I think with all of the evidence and lots of the activists sat in the courtroom and could hear the evidence, I think people really were still very hopeful that this time we would have a different result.
You know, one of the parts of these protests, aside from the property damage that we talked about, I mentioned, which is police allegedly chanting, according to AP and other news sources, chanting "whose streets, our streets" as they were arresting protesters. Does that have a particular resonance for you, Amy Hunter, police officers chanting in that way as they do their jobs in the streets?
I think it helps really prove the point of the people who are in the street on the way that they are treated and the behaviors of law enforcement. I don't think, of course, you know, being pro something isn't anti-officer. I don't even think the protesters believe that they're anti-officer. I believe that they feel like they're anti-police brutality, though. And even though those are just words, they're the same words that were chanted in Charlottesville with the tiki torches. They're not words that talk about being a loving, kind, collaborative, inclusive St. Louis. And so, you know, building trust with law enforcement is something that I am sure not just here, but other places are working on after Ferguson. However, when officers are acting in that way, it makes it even harder for communities to build relationships with them.
So you were part of protests after Ferguson and the death of Michael Brown, of course, in one of the suburbs of St. Louis. Does this feel similar? And if so, if you're doing the same kind of protest a couple of years later, does it feel like a lack of progress?
So I think people who were here prior to Ferguson would say there has been progress from our major companies, from our major corporations. Certainly where I work at St. Louis Children's Hospital, there's lots more conversations happening. Our leader, Joe Magruder, is incredibly supportive. And so we're all looking for positive change. And so I think that has been a positive outcome. We've got a great exhibit at our history museum. I mean, we have seen positive change since the wake of Ferguson. And so we understand that progress is slow and inevitable. So I think everyone is looking forward to the change that we're all seeking. I don't think anybody wants to go out and protest a feeling of an unjust system. I don't think anybody wants that to happen. I also don't think that anybody wants to see any more mothers grieving the loss of their children for any reasons. And so as many times as we can put an end to those moments, I think we should try to do that. And I don't think we've lost anything.
You know, Amy Hunter, one thing I noticed was that U2 canceled a planned concert in St. Louis in protest of this situation. And, you know, in so many other cases, we've seen protests that impact a city's bottom line that are the ones that can really be effective. I'm thinking of North Carolina with bathroom bills, Indiana, where corporations refuse to do business there. Is that the most substantive thing that has come from these protests so far, a major international rock band refusing to come to town?
Absolutely. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that the NAACP also, you know, alerted everybody of a travel alert coming to Missouri. So I think there are other organizations, kind of the momentum of keep your eyes out for how you might be treated when you come to our town, city, or state. But I definitely think that the organizers, as smart and strategic as they are thinking about what is the economic impact to really draw attention to people noticing that in a place that we all call our town, everyone doesn't feel safe all the time. In a place where we should feel safe, and getting nervous at something as easy as a traffic stop just should not happen. And that's not the world that we want to create. So people are in the streets so that we can create a better world than the world that we currently see.
Well, Amy Hunter, thank you for joining us once again. We do appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Hunter, native Missourian and manager of diversity and inclusion at St. Louis Children's Hospital.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo, offering print products with features like Printfinity, a technology that gives the ability to print a different image on every business card. Learn more at Moo.com. And by Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com.
You know, presidents have a lot of weapons at their fingertips. The United States Navy is one. There's a veto pen, even a nuclear arsenal. But with all of that firepower, sometimes the president just needs to kill with a couple of good jokes. So where did President Obama turn when he needed a laugh? One of his writers was David Litt.
To me, I always loved the jokes that were a little edgy. They weren't inappropriate, but they had some edge to them, and they got at some political truth that you're just not allowed to say normally as a public figure.
David Litt arrived in the White House in 2011 and left in 2016 as a special assistant to the president and senior presidential speechwriter. You might remember Luther, President Obama's anger translator, played by Keenan-Michael Key of Key & Peele. Luther showed up at the 2015 White House Correspondents' Dinner, and that bit was Litt's creation.
In our fast-changing world, traditions like the White House Correspondents' Dinner are important.
I mean, really? What is this dinner? And why am I required to come to it? Jeb Bush, do you really want to do this?
Well, David Litt may be a little young for memoirs, but he has one out today nonetheless. It's called Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. It describes a time when he was fresh out of college and an internship at The Onion, and remembering the first time that a joke that David Litt wrote emanated from presidential lips.
Well, the first joke was, it was for the Radio and TV Correspondents' Dinner, and it was about Chuck Todd, who's now the host of Meet the Press, and President Obama said,
"At this dinner, Chuck embodies the best of both worlds. He has the rapid-fire style of a television correspondent and the facial hair of a radio correspondent."
Which, you know, I admit, and I say this in the book, it was not comedy gold, but I was on YouTube watching it over and over and over again. I was like, those were my words. The president just said them. And I told that to my parents, and I think they thought it was, you know, pretty cool, but also they recognized that, like, as jokes go, this is maybe not the funniest thing they ever heard.
And yet good enough to be uttered by the most powerful person in the world in front of a bunch of reporters in Washington.
Absolutely. And so much of the joke when President Obama was telling a joke is that it's President Obama telling a joke. That's where the humor comes from. It's why when I repeat some of these jokes, or I did them in the audiobook and was like, I don't know that that's going to land, but they landed in the room because it was the president being self-aware, playing with his own persona, and he had that sense of timing that, frankly, I don't.
So you're an intern at The Onion. You're in Washington, D.C. You get a pretty good, not great joke through the president at the 2009 dinner. 2011, you get hired on at the White House, and then I'm sure your eyes just got wide.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every time I would go up to the gate and I'd show them my badge and they'd let me in, and I'd be like, this makes no sense. you know, people smarter than me, more capable than me, should be working at the White House. And I talk about in the book that the first time I interacted with the president, we were actually in the diplomatic room of the residence, which is one of the most beautiful rooms in the White House. It has this mural of rural American life. And I was in there. I had done the Thanksgiving video address, and President Obama walked into the room, and he's standing up. So we all stand up, and he sits down. So we all sit down, and he's about to start taping when the videographer, a woman named Hope Hall, stops him and says, "Actually, Mr. President, hang on. This is David. It's the first video he's ever written for you." And President Obama looks at me and he goes, "Oh, how's it going, David?" And I remember I had exactly one thought in that moment, which was, I did not realize I was going to have to answer questions. And then I literally have no idea what I said. I actually blacked out the first time I met President Obama.
But then he became the guy that you had to write for on a regular basis. And you talk about in this book, when it comes to writing jokes for the president, the need to be poignant, funny, self-deprecating is important. But there's also tons of subtext anytime the president opens his mouth. You talk about one event that really interested me. It was a thing called the Alfalfa Dinner in 2009. Now, the Alfalfa Club is conservative, staid, sort of white coattails organization that has its annual dinner on the birthday of Robert E. Lee. And here's President Barack Obama gets up in front of the captains of industry and the famous politicians in white ties at the Alfalfa Club dinner and says, "If Robert E. Lee were with us here tonight, the general would be 202 years old and very confused," says the first black president.
That's right. And I wrote about jokes like that because it was, to me, a good example of walking that line. He wasn't doing anything outrageously inappropriate, but he was able to assert himself and say, "Hey, there's something not quite right about this, and I'm going to get at it through humor, but I'm going to get at it."
Well, we've been talking about the humor of politics, but we also have to talk about the politics of humor, because there's no way around it when you're writing for the president. Even when you write funny jokes and people laugh, you're still image making for the president. You're still trying to win the cycle. If the president's in a tough spot, you want to write great jokes that are going to change the news in his favor, right? And you talk about writing jokes at a time just after the spectacular failure of healthcare.gov and the need to get the president out there loose and funny and self-deprecating at a politically disastrous time.
Yeah, it was a difficult time, but we felt like we had turned a corner at that point, because despite the launch of the website, which was a total mess, by that point, 8 million people had signed up for healthcare. We felt like we were back on track. So it was both a chance to acknowledge our mistakes, but also let people know that we've moved past them. By being confident, by the president making fun of himself, he was able to basically say, "Okay, I'm taking my lumps, but let's move forward on this thing."
Of course, we rolled out healthcare.gov. That could have gone better.
And I think that is something that humor can do. People always used to ask me, "Do you write jokes to try to advance the president's agenda?" And I would always say no, by which I always meant yes. And the reason for that was just I felt it ought to be worth the president's time to go tell a bunch of jokes. If he's going to have to do this, and it's clearly not the most important part of his job, let's make it integrate in some way into everything else he's doing. And I think the Obama White House did that more effectively than any White House thus far.
So what's funny about politics right now to you?
To me, what is funny about politics, but it can also, it's very bittersweet, is just that we've reached this level of absurdity where the day-to-day of politics is what you'd expect out of a writer's room. I mean, you had the press secretary of the White House hide behind a bush to avoid taking questions from reporters, and then a few months later, after being fired, show up at the Emmys to do a guest spot. I mean, this is an arc of a show where you would say, okay, we got to tone that down. It's totally unrealistic. And that's where we're living now. But there are fun things you can do with that. There's ways to put a different angle on something that we haven't seen before. And I think the other thing that's exciting about political comedy right now is the chance to be a real part of our political conversation.
The book is Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. The author is David Litt, former White House staffer and joke writer for President Barack Obama. David Litt, thanks for coming.
Thank you so much.
You can hear a lot more of my conversation with David Litt. There's an extended cut on our website at thetakeaway.org that includes a lot more funny moments, plus David Litt imagining writing for President Donald Trump. So what do you think? Do politicians need to be funny? We got a listener in Acme, Washington, sending us their answer to that question, which is yes. My favorite is when liberal Senator Al Franken told conservative Senator Lindsey Graham that if he could, he would vote for Graham for his re-election, to which Lindsey Graham replied, "That is my problem." Yeah, pretty good. Good political joke there. Well, whatever you think about political humor, we always want to hear from you. Your jokes, your take. Give it to us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can send your tweets to us at The Takeaway, and you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.